From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the FBI and the State Department are denying there was any deal struck in last year's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. In a document released by the FBI yesterday, a State Department official asks FBI officials to make one email unclassified. He was denied, but at issue is whether the FBI asked for or the State Department offered a favor in return. And while both deny that, the Trump campaign is seizing on it as proof of a cover-up. Well, will any of this sway any voters? Let's go to Arizona. The state has only voted for a Democrat for president twice since 1948, but polls show this race is a toss-up. Here in House, Peter O'Dowd is in Tucson. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Robin.
And start with that. Are you hearing about the FBI emails or the WikiLeaks leaked emails on the ground there?
Well, look, Republicans here will bring it up without prompting, so you know it matters to them. But I've also met Arizona voters who are on the fence about Clinton, who worry that she's untrustworthy in part because of issues like these emails. And this news is not really going to ease their minds. But that could really matter because Clinton needs every vote that she can get here in the state.
Well, and you're telling us she's trying to get it. Yesterday, Clinton's campaign said they're spending $2 million on TV, mail, digital ads in Arizona. Do they think they can win?
Yeah, suddenly they're feeling really confident. Bernie Sanders is coming today. Chelsea Clinton and Michelle Obama are on their way later this week. So a lot of firepower coming to Arizona. Clinton's state director in the state, Seth Scott, says that they've got 180 staffers and 33 offices working to elect Democrats statewide.
33 is quite a bit for Arizona. This may be the most offices any Democratic operation has had in the state in our history. It's certainly most staffers we've had in our history.
But look, Robin, a spokesman for the state GOP says that they're just as energized as the Democrats are. They've knocked on 350,000 doors. And let's just be clear that the odds are in Trump's favor because this is Arizona, a state where Republicans outnumber Democrats by a pretty healthy clip. And 2 years ago, Republicans swept away statewide elected offices here.
Well, and you've been traveling the border for the past few days, and Donald Trump has put immigration security at the center of his campaign, promised to build the wall, create a deportation force. So is that part of the message that is helping Trump there?
Well, it's helping amongst his base. For a voter in a Republican primary, that message works very well. But Arizona is changing. It's very different, and it's all about demographics now. 6 years ago, I was here covering SB 1070. It's the Show Me Your Papers immigration law that passed in 2010. And at that point, Latinos were so angry. They promised that they were going to go to the polls and reject these types of policies. But it didn't really happen, and it didn't really come to maturity until just this year. Alejandro Gomez has been trying to get Latinos to the polls ever since SB 1070, and she told me that her group got 150,000 Latinos registered statewide this year, which was more than they did in the previous 5 years combined, and it totally blew away their expectations.
We started off with 75 as our goal, and it just kept increasing. I think I get a little bit emotional because in 2010, there was so much fear, and we didn't know what the solution was going to be.
So this could be part of their solution. In a tight race, every vote's going to count.
Yeah, but as you said, will they come out on election day? What's the sense?
Well, you know, 22% of eligible voters in Arizona are Latino. It's a big number, but it doesn't matter if they don't come out to vote. And that's the point that Stan Barnes has been making. He's a Trump voter. He's a former Republican state lawmaker as well. And he tells me that every year the Latinos disappoint at the ballot box and that Donald Trump, there's no way he's going to be the Latino agitator that the Democrats are counting on.
Somehow, the Latino voters don't get the memo from some of their self-appointed leaders. Either they don't vote, or when they do vote, they behave differently than expectations.
And this is fascinating, Robin. Barnes is actually more concerned about Trump losing Arizona because he loses the Mormon vote, which is a relatively small group of voters, but it's very reliably Republican. And we know that Trump has been struggling with Mormons in Utah.
Yeah. Well, we just want to ask you in the minute we have about the other famous name there, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, up for re-election. But he was hit yesterday with federal contempt of court charges. So how is that race shaping up?
Yeah, that charge is related to a pretty longstanding federal racial profiling case against Arpaio. His supporters say, look, the timing is so close to an election, this is very suspicious. But you have to think that if Donald Trump is vulnerable in Arizona this year, then Joe Arpaio would be too. They've campaigned together. They have similar stances on immigration. They were both out front for years on the birther issues. But look, this is Arizona at the end of the day. It has been fertile ground for Trump and Arpaio. who, by the way, has been reelected every year since 1992.
Yeah. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, clear across the country, there was a debate last night in Florida for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Marco Rubio. He's being challenged by Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy. And joining us to talk about that race for this week's Senate Tracker is Patricia Mazzei, political writer for the Miami Herald. Hi, Patricia.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. And it didn't take long last night for the presidential campaign to come up. Marco Rubio is standing by his endorsement of Donald Trump. Here's what he had to say.
And when it comes to this election, I've already admitted to you, this is two less than ideal options that we have before this country. I'm not arguing here that this is a race between Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. These are two deeply flawed candidates, which is why it's so important, as I've already said repeatedly, that we have a candidate for the U.S. Senate that, if elected, will stand up to these people. In this election, the only one that stood up to both candidates is me.
That sound courtesy of WMFE in Orlando. Patricia, how has Rubio's support of Trump factored into this race?
Well, he has maintained a lead throughout the summer, which is when he announced his reelection kind of late in the game. But it's always been narrow. And so what we are seeing right now is a potential ticket splitting effect where a lot of voters intend to vote for Hillary Clinton for president and Marco Rubio for Senate. But I think what you saw in the debate is that he's worried there might be some sort of wave effect on the Democratic side that could wipe out his lead. So he's had to position himself in such a way where he is a critic of both Clinton and Trump, even though he is saying he's still going to vote for Trump.
And what about Congressman Patrick Murphy, who has endorsed Hillary Clinton? Does that play a role in the race as well?
Well, it has opened this line of attack from Rubio, where he says, you know, you would not be a good check on Clinton if she were the president. The Clinton campaign has been spending money in Florida for down ballot races. They have actually recently this week announced more money coming to Florida to benefit candidates, including Murphy. However, national Democrats were supposed to play a bigger role in this race. They had intended to spend a lot of money here, and they have been pulling back because Rubio continues to lead in polls. And so even though Murphy has been a loyal supporter of Clinton's, that might not be enough to get national Democrats to really spend heavily in a state that is so expensive.
One of the issues that came up last night was the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando that happened in June. And Congressman Murphy, in talking about that, called Senator Rubio anti-gay. Here's their exchange.
And the audacity that you have to say that you decided to run for the Senate after this Pulse nightclub shooting, when you've been one of the most anti-gay senators in the country and done nothing to prevent these tragedies from happening.
Nancy.
Excuse me. What's shameful is your effort to politicize a horrible tragedy for our country, which was a terrorist attack by radical Islamic terrorists that we could have defeated had it not been for people like you who continue to support these devastating cuts to our military, which you said would make us stronger.
How has the Orlando shooting and gun control fit into this race?
Well, if you noticed in that clip, Rubio didn't really address that anti-gay accusation from Murphy. Rubio opposes same-sex marriage, for example, and he was heavily criticized by the Murphy camp when he went to speak to evangelical pastors a couple months ago in Orlando. But Rubio used that speech to talk about how Christians should not judge the LGBT community, even if they don't believe that they should get married. As for gun control, Murphy has a TV ad here in Florida where he features one of the moms of one of the victims of the Pulse shootings endorsing him and talking about how he would be better to fight gun violence. Rubio has said, well, you know, I proposed a bill that would try to work around this, you know, no fly, no buy idea where if you've been under investigation by the FBI for terrorism, you would appear on a watch list if you tried to buy a gun. So it's been an issue because the shooting happened in June and shortly after Rubio said he was going to run for re-election. And it was in Orlando that his friend, the lieutenant governor who was running for Senate, Carlos Lopez Cantera, told Rubio, you know, I think you should run. And that was one of the key moments where Rubio decided, I'm getting in this race.
What are the polls saying right now about the race in Florida?
Rubio has been up in the polls for nearly two dozen polls now. I mean, since the summer, he's up nearly 5 percentage points over Murphy. The polls show that Murphy remains unknown among a large swath of voters. He did not debate in the primaries against Congressman Alan Grayson. And so we had a University of North Florida poll recently show 36% of Florida voters don't know who he is. That number is even higher among Hispanics, especially Spanish-speaking Hispanics, who make up 15% of Florida's electorate. And Marco Rubio is Cuban-American and can speak directly to them. So Murphy's got some challenges here in the last 3 weeks of the race.
That's Patricia Mazzei, a political writer for the Miami Herald, talking with us about the Senate race in Florida between Marco Rubio and Patrick Murphy. Patricia, thanks.
My pleasure.
The military offensive to retake Mosul from ISIS is in its second day. The large and complex operation, which includes the Iraqi military, Kurdish troops, and support from the U.S.-led coalition, could last for weeks or even months. And there are many questions about what happens if Mosul falls, who will be in charge there. Joining us now is Paul Bremer, who led the coalition provisional authority in Iraq after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003 that toppled Saddam Hussein. He was also ambassador at large for counterterrorism under President Reagan, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
And you released a statement yesterday about the importance of retaking Mosul, which reads, "It will be a vital demonstration that ISIS is losing. They lost Dabiq over the weekend and, of course, their headquarters in Raqqa, which will presumably follow after the fall of Mosul. So this is an important part of the strategy against ISIS." How important is the retaking of Mosul in the fight against ISIS, do you think?
Well, I think it's a vital first step in the strategy. Ultimately, we have to take them down in Raqqa as well. And I'm quite optimistic about the Mosul operation, though I think there are some important questions that are still on the table.
Questions like what?
Well, there are three things, I think. First of all, can this be done? Can the city be liberated at an acceptable cost to the Iraqi people? Secondly, can security be established in Mosul afterwards? That's obviously vital for any government. And then longer term, can a system of non-sectarian governance be put in place in Mosul? And I think these are the three challenges that the Iraqis and their allies like us will follow on after the fall of Mosul.
Well, how do you make sure that there can be a real system of governance that is respected in Mosul after it falls? After ISIS no longer has control?
I think the main challenge, and it's clear that the Iraqi prime minister understands that, is to avoid having the Iranian-backed Shia militia play an important role. It seems clear that their intention is to not have those militia who are coming mostly from the south and southeast towards Mosul, that they will not be allowed to do the final assault on the urban center itself. And I think that indicates the understanding on the part of the Iraqis that they have to avoid a sectarian approach to the liberation of this big city.
We were speaking with Mike Giglio, who's BuzzFeed's reporter there covering the retaking of Mosul, who said that one of the problems was that he saw looking forward was that even if the Kurds right now are helping out in the fight against ISIS, that after the fact, they're not going to be on the same page as the Iraqi government about control of Mosul.
Well, Mosul is a complicated place. It's got not only a large Kurdish population, it also has quite a few Turkmens. So the Turks are going to be interested in what happens in Mosul. And you, have the Sunni Arabs. The Kurds are also Sunnis by and large, but not Arabs. So it's a complicated mosaic of a place. And all of those questions, like the role of the Kurds, will certainly have to be raised. That's why I said I think the third and most important challenge is to put in place a respectable form of governance for this city. It's the second largest city in Iraq, after all.
What about the American role in this? American forces are involved in airstrikes and firing artillery in this offensive. Technically, they're not involved in combat, but a lot of people say that's really a matter of semantics. Last year, you said President Obama should conduct a more vigorous air campaign against ISIS and redeploy 10,000 troops to fight ISIS. Do you still feel that way? Do you think that the American role is adequate?
Well, we did. I mean, since then, the president has stepped up and, of course, right now, very much stepped up the air operations. And I think that's a good sign. I don't think we need the 10,000 troops at the moment, largely because the process of rebuilding the Iraqi army capabilities has been so successful. After all, this this army, and particularly the counterterrorism forces, have already liberated Ramadi, Fallujah, Tikrit, Beji, a number of cities. So they know how to do this. And still, as you point out, we do have combat forces on the ground. We have boots on the ground, to use the other metaphor that is so abused. They are playing an important role in intelligence gathering, targeting, and planning operations, and of course in logistics. And I welcome that. I congratulate the president on reversing himself. We now have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 troops on the ground.
You think there should be more American troops?
I don't have a view on that now. I certainly felt some years ago that we needed 10,000, and now we're at maybe 6. So I'm not a military expert. We have done what I think we needed to do, and to try to undo the mistake that was made by the administration of pulling the American troops out in 2011.
Well, let's get to that, because there is a lot of conflict about that and whether that decision, which was a decision that the Bush administration had made to pull the troops out, whether that was the reason that ISIS was formed. Do you agree with that? That's what Donald Trump thinks.
Well, just because he thinks it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. It was a mistake to pull them out. It was not the Bush intention was to negotiate an agreement to keep troops after the end of 2011. The Obama administration made the decision not to do that. This was a mistake. I think it can be seen fairly clearly. Al-Qaeda had been defeated by the American-trained Iraqi army by the end of 2009. When this administration came to office in early 2009, the vice president announced that they had inherited a stable and politically diverse democracy in Iraq. That was, I think, reversed when we pulled the troops out in 2011. And you see that the ISIS, which is really Al-Qaeda in Iraq version 2, immediately took the field. So I don't think there's much doubt about that's what happened. The question now is, can we, once Mosul is liberated, and I'm confident it will be, do we repeat the mistake and turn our backs again? We need to be sure we're there to help the Iraqis continue the training of their forces, providing adequate security, working on intelligence and special operations.
You say the Obama administration made the decision not to do that, though. Weren't they doing that? Didn't they make that decision because the Iraqi government wouldn't provide amnesty for U.S. soldiers in Iraq?
Well, the word amnesty is incorrect. The discussion was about having a status of forces agreement, a SOFA. We have them with some 80 or so countries, or have had over the last 70 years. Prime Minister al-Maliki was willing to sign that agreement as an executive agreement, and the administration said no, he had to take it to parliament, which politically for him was very difficult. As a result, the administration was able to say, we got no SOFA, and therefore we'll pull our troops back. By the way, the 6,000 troops who are operating there now are not operating under a SOFA. So this was an excuse that was made in October or November of 2011 to do what the president wanted to do, which was to get the troops out and declare the war over.
Well, do you share his concern if that is true, that the president just wanted to get the troops out, and that is, of course, something he campaigned on? Do you share his concern about the U.S. getting bogged down by continually sending more troops into Iraq to deal with every city that has to be retaken, et cetera?
Well, of course. I don't think any American politician wants to get our troops, our men and women, brave men and women, involved in something called bogged down. I think, as I said, I give the president credit. He reversed himself. We now have thousands of troops on the ground in combat in Iraq. This is probably the biggest and most important operation that we'll be involved in, because it is the second largest city. The third largest city, Basra, in the south is relatively peaceful. So I think one can find the way to reduce the number of American troops there once Mosul is liberated, but it would be a serious mistake to pull them all out. The next president will have to address that question, I'm sure.
How do you respond to people who go back even further for the sort of start of ISIS, or what became ISIS, and don't blame it on the U.S. pulling troops out, but rather the U.S. putting troops in the first place and invading Iraq, and they say that destabilized the country, that's what led to what eventually became ISIS?
Well, to take that position, you have to make the argument that Iraqis and Americans would be better off with Saddam Hussein still in power, and a Saddam Hussein by this time would have nuclear weapons. We know he had his intentions. We know from the post-war interrogations of his associates that he had the plans, personnel, and policies in place to resume his weapons of mass destruction program. I find it very hard to believe that people can make a serious argument that Iraqis and American interests would be better served if Saddam were still in power. That, to me, is the conclusive argument that it was right to take him out.
But even if that is your view on that, what about that argument that ISIS started as a result of that war?
Well, it's not true. There was al-Qaeda already in Iraq. Its first version was called a terrorist group, a Sunni-based terrorist group called Ansar al-Islam, which was there before the war, which then was taken over by main al-Qaeda under a Jordanian named Zarqawi. And he launched the terrorist attacks already in the summer of 2003 while I was still there. So al-Qaeda was already operating there and was operating more energetically. I have written and spoken often on my view that we did not provide adequate numbers of troops in Iraq to deal with the problems we faced in 2003-2004. There's not much point in relitigating. I've made the point.
Do you have thoughts on the presidential election coming up that you want to share with us?
I really don't. I'm going to have a very hard time figuring out how to vote.
That's Paul Bremer, who led the coalition provisional authority in Iraq after the U.S.-led invasion. He was also ambassador at large for counterterror under President Reagan. Paul Bremer, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
The weather map is interesting today. The eastern half of the country is in the 70s and 80s, a fall heat wave. Much of the northeast is at peak fall foliage, which is triggering the annual hunt for the most perfect leaf-peeping spot. And two reporters with Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio decided to go deep. Brian Mann and David Summerstein trekked more than 12 miles into New York's Adirondack Mountains. Here's their audio postcard.
We've been hiking maybe 20 minutes and we come to a ledge of rock framed with shimmering light.
I didn't think we climbed far enough to even deserve this.
That's my colleague David Summerstein. We're on our way up Giant Mountain through stands of fiery maple and birch. This first overlook feels cinematic, like something out of Lord of the Rings.
I would say that that is peak color that we're looking at. It's just vast sort of swaths of red with little bits of yellow and orange mixed in.
Yeah, beautiful, like, rust blanket, like, going through that, you know, valley there.
We climb through the morning and get above the tree line where the view is bigger, with more mountains and a sea of fog in the valleys.
You can see it in strips. There's, like, a strip of fog and then some mountains that poke up, then another strip of fog and then some more mountains that poke up.
I wish I was at my desk right now. My cubicle calls me, and I must go.
As we climb, there are still echoes of summer, crickets chirping in the sun-soaked rocks. Soon we reach the top of Giant Mountain. At 4,600 feet, it's one of the highest places in New York State.
I just kind of feel like we're like looking at the whole Adirondacks.
The scale is that big, the colors that rich. We're in a kind of trance now. We can't stop. Our next challenge, a ridge trail that stretches another 8 miles through the wilderness, hopping from summit to summit.
If you don't hear from us, come looking for us.
If you find this recording, like in Blair Witch Land or something.
For us, this is pretty ambitious. David's in his mid-40s. I'm past 50. So we're already a little achy as we set off. Achy but grateful.
Every single place we come to is just an amazing place to stop. This is this just perfect, flat, rocky outcropping.
I'm running out of adjectives. I certainly don't have any more fall color adjectives. You know, it's like stained glass, it's jewelry, it's
Monet.
Tapestry. Monet. Okay, good. It's mid-afternoon now, and we've traversed a lot of the ridge. So that was a tough patch.
Yeah, we came down a long, steep ravine, and we've come out into this just glow under an entire stand of birch trees with just bright yellow, electric yellow leaves.
Tell me how your legs feel.
My knees hurt. I will say this. We were offered one more view just now, a little side view trail, and we did not take it. We were viewed out. But, man, it's an absolutely magical hike.
It's dusk as we wind our way down out of the mountains. Our middle-aged legs, they're beyond creaky, but our heads are filled with color. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann with David Summerstein in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
The 2015 census was recently released, and there have been some improvements in the economy. Median income rose by 5.2% from 2014. The overall poverty rate dropped to 13.5%, down from 14.8% the previous year. But when it comes to children, the picture is bleaker. 20% of the country's 74 million children are living below the poverty line, many well below. So how does the wealth gap affect kids? You know the stats. The top 1% of Americans make over $389,000. The median income is just over $56,000. CEOs make 331 times what the average worker earns. So for the first of our occasional look at young people and the gap, let's check in with Renee Wilson-Simmons, director of the National Center for Children in Poverty at Columbia University. Renee, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
We feel like we're seeing this anecdotally, some people who straddle the economic divide. You have maybe in one family, in an extended family, kids who have little kids who have iPhones, and in another, little kids who don't have enough to eat. Are you seeing a bigger gap?
If we're saying that 20% of our children are living in poverty, that means that the youngest, the most vulnerable to risk to their health and development, and the poorest residents of our nation are our children. And that's a huge concern.
Well, and, you know, just list off some of the impacts. What are you seeing?
Well, we know that poverty can cause or exacerbate poor health. It can impede children's cognitive development and their ability to learn. It contributes to social, emotional, and behavioral problems. And we know that children who experience poverty when they're very young or for long periods of time are at greatest risk for poor outcomes. But the thing that we'd like to focus on above all else is that we know that children do better when families do better. So we're the National Center for Children in Poverty, but we can't just focus on the healthy development of children because that can't happen without focusing on the supports that parents need to nurture their children.
Well, but what about the fact that we see more now of the gap? We are able to see into wealth perhaps more than ever, you know, the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Children are seeing the differences perhaps more than ever before. How does that impact them?
You're absolutely right about them seeing more because they're let into the lives of people who, under normal circumstance, they would never interact with. They can see the clothes, the food, all of the things that are very far out of reach for them. Over the past three decades, really, there's been a growing share of the public that's come to view American society as divided into two groups, the haves and the have-nots. And as early as 1988, Gallup conducted a poll asking the very simple question, is America divided into the haves and have-nots? 71% said no, and 26% said yes. In 2011, it was no, 52%, and yes, 45%. And in that year, 73% of blacks said yes, and 40% of whites.
And let's just remind ourselves a little bit of a background, because we have been reminded recently the institutionalized economic divides. It's not just income, it's wealth that isn't passed down in many African-American families in particular because they received little of the assistance post-World War II, things like the GI Bill to buy homes. There was redlining by banks that kept them from getting loans. Black farm workers and domestic workers rarely had Social Security. This subtracts from the kind of wealth that gets passed along generation after generation. There aren't the homes to sell, the businesses to pass on, the Social Security to leave. And you say that, again, talking about kids, one of the biggest myths is that people can just climb out of this by working harder.
You know, I am so glad you said that. It's this you can make it if you try perspective. And successive polls that were conducted by Pew Research have found that at every income level, not just at some income levels, at every income level, Americans are far more likely than, say, Europeans to believe that individuals, not society, are responsible for their own failures, both economic and otherwise. And at the core of it is this American dream, the belief that anybody who works hard can move up economically regardless of his or her social circumstances. And unfortunately, despite the data and the history, Americans overestimate the amount of upward social mobility that exists in society. So national polling by Pew found that 40% of Americans consider it common for a person in the U.S. to start poor, to work hard, and become rich. And the truth is that 43% of Americans raised at the bottom of the economic ladder, they remain stuck there as adults, and 70% never make it to the middle. And the chances of moving up and down the income scale have been relatively unchanged over the last 20 years. So by overemphasizing individual mobility, we ignore some of these important social determinants of success, like those you've mentioned, family inheritance, social connection, structural discrimination. And, you know, it was the late George Carlin who said the reason they call it the American dream is because you have to be asleep to believe it.
You talk about the inability to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. How much more difficult is that if part of getting into the workforce, part of advancing now, seems to include technology, iPhones, internet access, cable television, not available to many low-income homes?
What we consider basic needs has changed considerably over time, especially with advances in technology. And while many homes may have cable TV, the other needs are often not met. When we talk about the needs of children and the importance of succeeding in school, we sometimes make assumptions about home life, about the fact that you have technology available, about the fact that you have a place to study. Well, do you have a place to study? Is there an adult available to help? Is an adult available who's able to help? And one that people often don't think about that's a chronic stressor for children is noise.
When we're talking about access to information, to culture, you mentioned Sesame Street.
Yes, the sad tale of Sesame Street. We think of Sesame Street as the favorite brownstone and that there was access for everyone. But today, Sesame Street isn't available to everyone because it's only available through HBO. When we think about that as the one thing that all children had access to, even that is no longer available.
And talking again about the older kids with the new technology, their learning tools, iPhones, the internet, your laptop, if you don't have them, it may contribute to something called the summer slide.
Yes, during the summer when if you're in a more resource community, there are opportunities to continue to learn. And that's especially important for younger children and issues about being able to read at grade level. And the slips there for younger children are concerning. Mm-hmm. I really think it's this larger issue. And the issue, unfortunately, is a barrier to efforts to address child poverty and the disadvantage it engenders. And it's this belief that children are poor through no fault of their own. And so they deserve our support. But poor adults, their parents are responsible for the sorry situation in which they find themselves, and so they have to deal with it as best they can. The poor are perceived to be lazy, culturally deficient, criminally inclined, and reproductively prodigious. And I think that's a big one. Why so many kids? And financially inept. And now they're considered the undeserving poor. And I think those kinds of beliefs continue to put the health and development of many poor children in jeopardy. I mean, in terms of where we are as a nation in relationship to other countries, I think it's instructive to look at data from a recent report from the UN Children's Fund. It ranked the well-being of children in 35 developed nations. And I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
The United States ranked 34th of 35 countries surveyed. It was above only Romania. Romania. And this poor U.S. showing is a clear reflection of our nation's growing income inequality. And that would help explain why the U.S. on child poverty is ranked between Bulgaria and Romania, although Americans on average are 6 times richer than Bulgarians and Romanians. It's about what we think of the poor. And we think they're not deserving. And I think that unless we can change public perceptions, unless we can understand that there are reasons for the poverty and that there are effective approaches, I don't know how we're going to move forward.
Renee Wilson-Simmons, director of the National Center for Children in Poverty at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was a pleasure.
Netflix stock jumped 20% at the open on Wall Street this morning after the company announced a great quarterly result, adding about 3.6 million subscribers, in part thanks to this.
99 out of 100 times kid goes missing, the kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time?
Choice.
The one.
That is a clip from the Netflix series Stranger Things. Great show and part of a set of original content that may be driving the company's good numbers. Let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is senior editor of media for Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Peter.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. And tell us more about what Netflix said in its earnings call and why these results were so good.
Well, so Netflix is one of these companies that swings around wildly. Investors go nuts for when it does well, and they punish it when it does poorly. And so the roller coaster is going up for Netflix. It did better than Wall Street expected. It added about 3.5 million subs. Like you said, that's about 1.5 million more than Netflix had told Wall Street to expect. So Wall Street went bananas for it. And at some point in the next couple of days, some Wall Street will decide that Netflix is now too expensive and the stock will go back down again. But the general thrust of it is that Netflix continues to add subscribers quarter after quarter. There's a big debate about sort of how long that can go on for, but right now it's growing a lot.
And is it about shows like Stranger Things? Do they gain the subscribers when something like that blows up and then people stick with them even after they're done watching that show?
That is what Netflix says. You have to take them on faith because Netflix never reports any numbers about the performance of any individual show. This drives rival TV networks bananas. And they never tell you who sticks around. They never tell you why someone leaves. So you have to do some sort of guessing, and you sort of have to take them on faith that when they say shows like Stranger Things or Narcos are adding subscribers, that that's actually what's happening.
Now, there's Netflix in the United States, but they're also in more than 100 countries around the world. Tell us about their push into international markets and how important that is for their business.
So Netflix used to be a DVD company in the U.S., then it was a streaming video company in the U.S., and the last few years it's made a very big international push. At the beginning of this year, it basically said we're now going to be available in every market around the world except for China. And I think there's about 45 million people in the U.S. who get Netflix and maybe 40 million around the rest of the world. Those are rough numbers. So the what Wall Street's very excited about and what Netflix is telling them is there's tons of growth available everywhere outside the U.S. So U.S. growth is going to sort of slow over time.
And why not China?
That's another good question. Beginning of the year, China's Netflix said it was optimistic about getting into China, even though content companies and internet companies have struggled in China for a long time. And then in recent weeks have been saying, it doesn't look so good. And then yesterday said, actually, China's not going to work at all. We can't get in there. We can't work with government regulators and censors. And so what we're going to do is take the stuff we make and sell it to people who actually do business in China. And that's how we'll be in China. But we're not going to open up there anytime soon.
Now, we played the clip of Stranger Things at the top. There's also Narcos. There's Luke Cage. And then just last week, they debuted this mockumentary film, Mascots, from Christopher Guest. Here's a clip of that.
Mascotting is not unlike a marriage in that it's about cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
It's about listening.
Yeah.
Even if people are screaming at you, you're not allowed to talk. And that's a good lesson for a marriage.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, I watched it last week. It's not as good as Best in Show, I don't think, or Waiting for Guffman, but still, you know, a funny Christopher Guest film. But I want to ask you about how much Netflix is going to be putting into original content now. It's up to something like $6 billion is expected.
they're going to spend $6 billion on content, period. That's everything, including the stuff they buy from Disney and other traditional networks like Fox. In the past, they were saying, you know, initially the original content, stuff they make for themselves, was going to be a test. And recently been saying, actually, this is really going well. It might be up to 50% of the stuff we make going forward. They wavered on that yesterday. A better number is they said this year they're putting about 600 hours of original content out. Next year they'll do 1,000. So they're clearly betting on the idea that they can buy and create and order their own stuff that will do as well or better than the stuff they get from other folks.
Are they still?
They have to do that because some of the networks are saying we're not going to sell to you anymore.
Hmm. Are they still battling against the cable internet providers about bandwidth?
A little bit, although they pretty much seem to have resolved that. Comcast, which was sort of their big foe for a long time, they've now buddied up with. They're now they're working with Comcast to put Netflix on the Comcast Advanced set-top box. You can order it directly with a click from a Comcast remote control. So that issue seems to be resolved. The bigger issue is who's going to sell them content and where they're going to get it from. That's sort of a frenemy relationship as they described it yesterday.
And how do you think that this earnings announcement from Netflix plays at Hulu, Amazon Prime, or even cable providers, other content providers?
I think if you're the other guys, you generally say, wow, they seem to have found a big international audience. It's still working. We it's not news to them. They know there's a big international audience. The question is whether competitors like an Amazon have the ability, the willpower, the pocketbook to go out and find content that they can sell internationally as well.
That's Peter Kafka, senior editor of Media for Recode, talking with us about Netflix. Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.